What you are about to hear is the story of a connection that was made between a television series and a viewer's life. Our television set sits in the corner of our living room, befriending us, educating us, inspiring us, making us laugh or cry or tear our hair out in frustration. It is a far more constant companion than most of the friends we will ever make, or even our family. The You and Who books are the story of that companionship, that connection, as told by the people who watch the programmes that make us come alive, chiefly, of course, Doctor Who. This podcast will relate some of those stories. You're listening to You and Who Talking, and I'm J.R. Southall, the creator and chief editor of the series.
Hi, I'm Rob.
And I'm JR.
And you're listening to You and Who Are Talking, where this week we have, he's a return guest, JR, it's Steve Hatcher.
Yeah, this is his last time, or his last time.
Yeah,
I know.
For now.
He's been a bit of a mainstay, but yeah, this is the last one of all the things that he's written so far. But I think there's a very good chance he'll be back in the future.
Well, I hope so, because he does very well.
Yeah, yeah. And this is on The Guardians, which is a series that some people might remember, but I think it might be something that a lot of our listeners will find a bit of a mystery, maybe.
Yeah, it certainly is for me. And I mean, I watch some pretty eclectic stuff, but it's passed me by.
Yeah, maybe it's something that never made it abroad. I'm not sure.
Yeah, there are shows like that. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and this, of course, is ITV, as we will discover when Steve starts talking about, talking about how he came to see it. And that's quite the backbone of the reading that he does of the essay, how he came to see it, because this is an essay, and we shan't say too much, we'll let him tell the story, but this is an essay about the things that you might have caught on those occasions when you couldn't be watching Doctor Who for one reason or another.
That's right, and of course this comes from You and Who Else, which, if you've not read that particular book, is people's impressions of great British sci-fi and fantasy shows.
Yeah, it's like a companion to the Doctor Who books in that these are the other things that people who like Doctor Who like, as it were.
Exactly. So if you like Doctor Who, dip into that and you might find some stuff like this that you've never heard of and you might just like.
And this actually sounds like a really fascinating series. There's a bit of politics in the mix, which is going to be of interest to sort of people who like their early 1970s Doctor Who, I guess, and things like Doomwatch and all that kind of stuff that was going on at the time.
Yeah, great stuff, but we shan't spoil it.
No. Yeah. Let's let him get on and tell his story then, shall we?
All right, here's Steve.
When They Came For Us by Stephen Hatcher. I was not a typical child. When I was in my late teens and studying for a degree in modern languages and political studies, I read that the age at which most children become sufficiently politically aware they can name the Prime Minister of the day is around 7. I didn't recognise myself in that model. My first PM, or at least the first one that I could have named, had been Sir Alec Douglas Hume, 1963-64, whose brief and somewhat embarrassing tenure in office had more or less coincided with my 6th year. His predecessor, Harold Macmillan, wasn't a name I would have recognised, while his successor, Harold Wilson, and the 1964 general election that had brought him and the Labour Party to power a mere month after my 6th birthday, was very much a part of my young world. It was inevitable, really, that my trades unionist Communist Party member father would bring up a son who from a young age had an awareness of politics, and very much an appreciation of who were the good guys and the bad guys. I knew which side I was on. I was a child of the left. I cannot say that I followed all the developments of the second half of the 60s, as that bold Labour government, benefiting from the white heat of technology, set about transforming British society forever, sweeping aside the old certainties, as represented by a ruling class that seemed more and more stuck in the past. Revolutions were afoot in social policy, in the workplace, in sexual politics, in the role of women and young people. I was perhaps more aware of some of the international stories of the decade. It was impossible to escape Vietnam, which dominated every news bulletin, as the Americans, bad guys, attempted to prop up their client state in the south of the country, despite the efforts of the North Vietnamese and Viet Cong, good guys, and their leader Ho Chi Minh, very big hero. I was aware that these same Americans were engaged in what was described as a Cold War against the Soviet Union, that peace-loving, space-conquering workers' paradise whose utter superiority could only lead to their inevitable victory. I was very much aware of the evil of apartheid in South Africa, and of the obnoxious racist rebel regime in Rhodesia, although I was not aware that the Wilson government had discussed sending in British troops to end that particular nasty setup, apparently only to be thwarted by a warning from the military top brass that they would refuse to obey any orders to go into Rhodesia. I was aware that there were unpleasant, brutal regimes closer to hand, too. I knew about Franco in Spain and the Salazar-Gaetano dictatorship in Portugal, both relics of 1930s fascism that survived until the mid-70s and which had unenviable reputations for the suppression of any form of dissent and particularly for the arrest and torture of trade unionists. How could some of my friends and their families support these terrible people by going on holiday to Mallorca or the Costa del Sol each summer? Didn't they understand that the people that were being imprisoned, tortured and executed were ordinary working people trying to improve their lives? People like my dad. Perhaps they just didn't care. In April 1967, when I was still 8, a military coup brought the regime of the colonels to power in Greece, initiating a 7-year period of violent and ruthless repression. Now, I suspect that to most 8-year-olds living in the English Midlands, Greece was a long way away, and that events there had little bearing on their comfortable lives, but I was different. I knew that if there could be repressive military governments in Spain, Portugal or Greece, then it wasn't inconceivable that a similar thing could happen here. And in that case, it would be my family, my dad, perhaps my mum, perhaps even me, who would be in big trouble. Then, on Saturday 10th of July 1971, I saw episode 1 of the new LWT drama series, The Guardians. Saturdays always followed the same pattern in our family. Late in the afternoon, my parents, my younger brother David and I, would all set off to my grandparents' house at the other end of town. After tea, in summer perhaps there was time to play in the garden, or in winter to read the comics that Gran had bought for us. Then Grandad, Uncle Wilf and my dad would watch TV for a bit, while Gran, Mum and Auntie Jan would pop round to visit the neighbour, Mrs Andrews, before settling down for a chat at the far end of the room, to the sound of much giggling. All this, however, was merely the precursor to the evening's main event. Uncle Wilf would get ready, a shave in the kitchen, Brill cream and aftershave. Then he, Mum, Dad and Auntie Jan would be off out for an evening in the pub, leaving me and David in the charge of my grandparents. Now, those who know me as a Doctor Who fan, organiser of the Hoovers Group and the Hooverville Convention, may have noticed that something's missing. Saturday afternoon in the late 60s and early 70s, what about Doctor Who? Well, here we come to one of the great tragedies of my youth. I spent almost every Saturday of my childhood at my grandparents' house. I loved both of them dearly and still miss them terribly, 27 years after my granddad's death and 14 years after my grand's. My grandad, however, had a quirk, a peculiarity, an eccentricity. No matter what, he would only ever allow one channel on the television set in their living room, and it wasn't the BBC. My grandad only ever watched the ITV. For him, this was less of a preference, more of a principle. My gran wasn't bothered either way, but that sort of decision was left to my grandad, sitting in his armchair, pressed right up to the side of the set, as if guarding it. I never really got to the bottom of this bizarre behaviour. It may have been that my grandad regarded the staid old BBC as being too posh for the likes of us. Or it may have been that although he always paid his licence fee, by not watching the BBC, he felt justified in complaining about having to pay it. Convoluted logic. I'm not sure. It may have been just that he found the brash, flashy, often American offerings of the commercial channel more to his tastes. In any case, this odd predilection was a fact of life that we had to accept and get on with it. So while other children of the 60s were enjoying Marco Polo, Power of the Daleks, Evil of the Daleks, Fury from the Deep, and all those other long-lost Doctor Who classics, I was subjected to professional wrestling, which my grandad adored and took very seriously. Thank your lucky stars, and whatever imported glossy American rubbish ITV had invested in at any particular time. I particularly remember It Takes a Thief with Robert Wagner, and something with Gene Barry, possibly the name of the game. Doctor Who was one of those things that were spoken about in the school playground, but which I could only ever watch if I happened to catch some illness which prevented me from making the weekly trip to ITV land. There were some good things on ITV, though, especially Batman, which I adored and took very seriously. Then later in the evening, after supper of toast and a bowl of ready brek, yes, look at me, fat bloke, blame my gran, perhaps an ITC film series, maybe The Saint, or even better, perhaps The Avengers, which of course I absolutely loved. Then on Saturday, July the 10th, 1971, in the slot that the previous week must have hosted some such light-hearted adventure show, The Guardian stomped threateningly over the ITV network and over my young but politically aware consciousness. I was terrified. The story begins at some unspecified time in the 1980s. Some years previously, a military coup has swept away parliamentary democracy, elected government and even the monarchy. England is ruled by a government appointed by a behind-the-scenes military ruler, initially referred to as just the General, but who is later introduced as an incongruously affable character called Roger. We meet the Prime Minister, a liberally inclined retired university professor, Sir Timothy Hobson, played by Cyril Luckham, who has been brought in to be the benign face of the government. Hobson is a fundamentally decent man who believes he is acting in the interests of the country because democracy is a form of group suicide. Right from the opening scene of the first episode, however, we are introduced to the real power in the land, an armed paramilitary police force wearing uniforms and exhibiting behaviour reminiscent of the Gestapo of Nazi Germany. These are the Guardians of the Realm, usually referred to as just the Guardians or the G's. Ostensibly reporting directly to Hobson, it soon becomes clear that in fact they answer to almost no one other than the Cabinet Secretary Norman, played by Derek Smith. Operating from a network of fortified barracks that maintain their power through a high-profile armed presence on the streets, ruthlessly eliminating all protest and opposition, whether peaceful or violent. Over the course of 13 episodes, we are confronted by the different features of autocratic government and how it might work in England. We're forced to consider the distinction between terrorist and freedom fighter, to question the effectiveness of political assassination, hostage taken and the death penalty, and to look at the use of psychiatric hospitals as a means of controlling dissent, all of which were major contemporary issues in 1971, as many of them continue to be today. We meet a rising Guardians officer, Tom Weston, played by John Collin, and his wife Claire, Gwyneth Powell, later Grange Hill's head teacher Mrs. McCluskey. They are among the beneficiaries of the new regime, well off, living in a comfortable flat and expecting their first child. But Tom has a secret, which causes him to be arrested and disappeared, leaving Claire to suffer the consequences. By chance, she meets and falls in love with Hobson's semi-estranged and independently-minded son, Christopher, Edward Petherbridge, who helps her to discover what has happened to Tom. Government psychiatrist Frank Benedict, David Burke, and his wife Eleanor, Lynn Farley, are also apparently establishment insiders. However, Frank is secretly a member of a covert opposition cell known as a Quarmby, after the shared pseudonym of their various leaders. As the series progresses and the repressive nature of the Guardians becomes ever more evident, the Quarmbys are forced more and more to resort to violent means of protest themselves. We meet decent people who are faced with the question as to how far they are prepared to go to oppose oppressive government. In the case of the Benedicts, this very soon becomes a question of whether they are prepared to commit cold-blooded murder. Hobson begins reluctantly to question the role he is being forced to play. As he does so, he comes more and more into conflict with Norman and learns to become a skilled and wily political operator, but also inevitably more and more an autocratic ruler in his own right, until finally his principles assert themselves and he ceases to be useful to his masters. The series ends on a downbeat note, with the power of the Guardians undiminished and all those who sought to challenge them utterly destroyed. The Guardians is in many ways a rather old-fashioned series, rather wordy and often lacking in action, with many long two-handed scenes in which characters discuss the moral dilemmas which confront them. I don't think I ever saw a full episode of the 13-week run back in 1971. My mum and dad would come back during the course of the programme to take my brother and me home. This didn't make it any less disturbing for this 12 to 13-year-old. My 13th birthday fell on the Saturday that episode 12 was broadcast. Aware of events in Greece, Spain, Portugal and various other parts of the world, I knew that parliamentary democracy was imperfect and fragile, and that dark forces would be prepared to do what they considered necessary to maintain their power and position, even in comfortable, friendly, liberal UK. I knew also that if it did happen here, my family would be among the targets for the real-life equivalents of the Guardians. One day, they could well be coming for us, and that filled me with dread. What I did not know in 1971 was just how close the Guardians came to reflecting reality. From the mid-1970s onwards, information began to emerge that on at least two occasions in the preceding decade, senior establishment figures had met to discuss contingency plans to overthrow Labour governments under Howard Wilson. It would appear that one of the plans was for the Crown to dismiss Wilson in the same way that the Australian Labour government of Gough Whitlam was later dismissed, and for the Queen's cousin, Lord Louis Mountbatten, to serve as an unelected interim Prime Minister. In 1974, senior British Army officers, acting without any authorisation from Wilson or any other cabinet minister, implemented a lockdown of Heathrow Airport. This was passed off as an anti-terrorist measure, but the diaries of Wilson's political secretary, Marcia Faulkender, later revealed that both she and Wilson were severely shocked by this action, which they regarded as a show of force, or even a dress rehearsal for a coup. These events were later part of the inspiration for Labour MP Chris Mullen's novel A Very British Coup, 1982, turned into another chilling piece of television for Channel 4 in 1988. Had been aware of all this happening in the real world as I watched the fiction of The Guardians in 1971, how much more chilling the whole experience would have been. Whereas many shows that I watched and enjoyed as a child fell from my memory over the years, The Guardians held on tight. I remembered the name of the show, what it was about, and the disturbing title sequence featuring a squad of Guardians marching through London. When the splendid people at Network released a complete series a few years back, I devoured it. My 54-year-old eyes could see the imperfections that my 12-year-old eyes had missed, the odd creaky plot moment, the occasionally less than perfect performance. Nonetheless, this magnificent series still remains as powerful a warning now as it was in 1971. For me, it helped shape my views of British democracy and helped make me the political person that I remain to this day. And that article was written for the You and Who book, You and Who Else.
You've been listening to You and Who Talking, presented by Rob Irwin with J.R. Southall. The You and Who books, from which all royalties are paid to charity, are available in print and for Kindle from watchingbooks.weebly.com.